It's been a while since I've done this. I'm your old friend, John Larson. How is everybody? And we're here with a... How do they interview? How do they start out voices? You guys listen to voices, right?
Of course.
Yes.
I'm here as a guest host tonight. My good friend and the excellent director of the Voices podcast, Katrine, has given me a free pass. And we're here at the fabulous studio Fist in Your Face. This is your first visit here
for private
viewing, right?
Absolutely.
We do have a studio audience of two tonight. Hey guys. So welcome to your Voices interview. This is kind of like a rite of passage, right?
I feel like it is. This has been coming a long time, probably.
It's okay, Toby. It's okay to cry too. I'm just giving you permission.
I don't see any tissues, John. Are there tissues underneath the podium?
You know, that's true. Last time we were here a week or two ago, I made Lindsay sob and I had to give her napkins.
Aw, that's sad.
Yeah. So we're here tonight with my great friends, some of my two favorite people in the world. Pam and Toby, who are in from
sunny San Diego.
San Diego, yeah. Yeah. Where I serve my mission.
It's a beautiful place.
It is. I love it. And I'm going to be down visiting you soon.
I hope so. We keep hearing that.
I'm all full of promises and glitter. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit about your journey. Now, we met, just so to level set, we met on the Mormon Expression cruise, the Ensenada cruise in 2011,
January of 2011.
Yeah.
And I had to talk Toby into that cruise.
Yeah.
And I think eventually I just bought tickets. I kind of just said I was going to and did, and it was a great decision.
I remember looking for you. We had photos. We'd taken photos off of Facebook and created had a crib sheet. And we were looking for the model and her goofy-looking husband.
I think that's about right.
We had a fantastic time. I'm pushing this a little bit. I don't know if Voices is the right place, but I got to promote things everywhere. But we're probably going to have another cruise Ensenada this spring, probably in February of 2015.
Perfect.
Oh, my God. I'm getting old.
Ridiculous.
So I hope to see you guys there.
We'll be there.
It was a fantastic time, but that's where I met Toby and Pam, and I can still say that some of my best acquaintances, the people most important to me in my life, have come about through my connection to Mormonism. So I still have this love-hate relationship with it because, just about everybody I know, came out of the church. So that includes you guys.
And I would say the same thing. Absolutely. All my favorite people are Mormons, ex-Mormons.
Yeah, for sure. Now you guys have been, supporters and friends for a long time, and, you have been and continue to be moderators of the Mormon Expression Facebook community, right?
Yes.
Our old community had several rules, I think 15 or 16 rules, and we went over those in the secret podcast we recorded in Phoenix. It'll be available to people, but we only have one rule now, right?
Yeah, what is the rule?
I don't know what the rule is either.
The rule is whatever the mods say goes.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. And I have just gotten rid of people for bugging me. That's true.
And I say there is an appeal process. You can appeal the decision to me, and I will always side with the moderators.
Right. Well, I typically get rid of like sunglass selling people.
Every now
and again.
No, people are really well behaved in that group, so it's a good group.
It's the fear of absolute power. That's the only thing that keeps it in check.
It is. Every Facebook group that I know that works now, that isn't constantly having middle school drama, it's because it's ruled with an iron fist. All right, so let's talk about you guys. You started out as Mormons.
Yes, I was born into Mormonism. My mom's family's been in Mormonism always since Mormonism.
And you were a West Coast Mormon.
Sort of. I was born in Phoenix. That's where my parents grew up, and I lived all over the place. Actually, I lived in like 7 different states growing up. So. California, Texas, Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, kind of made the rounds of
Mormon in all of them.
Mormon in all of them. Yeah.
So you're what we call a mission field Mormon?
Mission field Mormon. That's what I was. Although, as a mission field Mormon, I would get really irritated when people said that. For some reason, it seemed insulting.
You really wanted to be in Utah. That's why.
No.
So, and Toby, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the thriving metropolis of Paul, Idaho, in Paul. South Central Idaho.
So Paul is near
Burley,
which is near,
which is then Twin Falls.
Okay, which is kind of close to some place.
Salt Lake.
Some place we might know sooner or later. Like Billings, there's like a Yellowstone somewhere
like
up around
halfway
there.
Halfway between Idaho Falls and Boise, kind of.
So were you a potato farmer, or what did you do up there?
My dad owned a welding shop that he had started with his dad, and so multiple generations in Idaho, and we were well established there, and really kind of grew up in the very traditional Idaho, you know, because real Mormons live in Idaho. The Utah Mormons are these liberal leftists. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So,
have you ever heard, the story up there in Idaho that Salt Lake will become the most wicked city on the planet? Did you ever hear that one?
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody knows that, John. It's the Constitution will be hanging by a thread. It's going to be saved by the guys in Idaho. I mean, that's without question it's going to happen.
All right. So you guys meet at BYU?
Sort of. I was at BYU for my freshman year. I got a job in the MTC cafeteria, and we met there.
So I'd like to say that I was on BYU campus. So there were a lot of years that we said that we met at BYU because technically speaking, that's correct.
Because you were a missionary.
I happened to be a missionary at the time on BYU campus, but I took up a habit of eating salad so that I could talk to Pam every day.
So did you guys start a letter writing campaign?
We did. So every day we would hand each other a letter, underneath the sneeze guard. And after a couple of weeks, we started making tapes for each other, including mixtapes, because back in those days, that was a thing. And
Toby's face.
Oh, it's so bad.
Mixtapes while you were still in the MTC.
Yes.
Well, obviously that was only one direction because I didn't have any sources.
If I remember right, it was more of a suggestion of what we were going to put on the mixtape when he could actually listen to the music. And I think I made it myself. And just, it was kind of sad. And, so we made tapes for each other that we thought, I listened to those over and over again, and so did he. And after we got married, we tried to listen to them again, and they were horrible. Like the most boring thing you can imagine.
You mean of talking to each other?
Yeah, we would just tell each other's life stories to each other.
Oh.
And, it was incredible. Know. I mean, we have to like digitize those, because I'm sure at some point in time.
For the archives, we'll add it as a bonus feature on this podcast.
Oh, I remember still, Pamela, she said that one of her favorite movies was Dances with Wolves. And the way that she pronounced that just made me laugh, and I teased her for years about that.
It's true, although being from Idaho, you probably shouldn't have teased me for the way I pronounce things.
Okay, so you guys you wait for him, apparently. Or kind of, sort of.
I mean,
we were friends.
We were friends. So yeah, we were friends, and we kind of wrote for most of his mission. We actually had a hiatus where we did not talk to each other at all for a while. And then we started up again, and I came to his homecoming in Idaho.
Wow.
And showed up there, and that was lots of fun. I think we went on our first date the next week.
Yeah.
Up to the Sundance Tree Room.
Yeah.
It's our first date.
I was a high roller.
The Sundance Tree Room.
It's a restaurant up Provo Canyon.
It's nice. All right, it wasn't a sizzler, so that means it's nice.
So you get married, you pump out a couple kids, a few years go by, and now you're here. So there was a crisis that sometime came along in your faith.
I'd like to think that our story is unique, but I'm sure that there's others. I mean, each of our arcs kind of follows similar arcs that other people have had. It's just the combination of the two that was odd for us. So we lived in Logan for a year, moved down to BYU. So we were both going to BYU. Are we jumping into the story now, or what are we doing?
Yeah,
now?
Unless you want to take us back to episode one.
Well, in the beginning, I was raised very, very traditional, very conservative, very much kind of rule, you know, follow the rules, do the right things. I was always very studious. I like to deconstruct things. And so I had always been pretty good as far as like Mormon doctrine goes and understanding things and putting things together. And I remember kind of thinking about for this podcast, I remember sitting outside of the, and I don't know if this is a fabricated memory or not. It could be. I'm going to actually go check it this weekend. But I remember sitting outside of the stake president's office, and they had a big replica of facsimile number 2 on the wall. And I looked at that, and I just studied it over and over and over again. And I'd crank open like the Pearl of Great Price and look at the writing. And it, you know, there's that piece in there that they kind of describe what each of the hieroglyphs mean, what the different sections are. And then there's that big teaser on, you know, that ought not to be revealed at this time, but if, you know, if men can figure it out, then so be it. I'm like, I just thought that was the coolest thing. And, you know, cause this is back before the internet. This is back before anything, you know, I didn't know anything about Egyptology. I didn't know anything about hieroglyphs. I just thought it'd be the coolest thing to figure out what these secret hidden meanings were. And so I kind of wondered, you know, why hadn't we translated that before? And why hadn't that, you know, where was that? So when I went mission right out of school at 18, I was still good Mormon boy, but I was very studious. So I ran into the, you know, the issue that a lot of people run into with Joseph Smith translation. This is something that actually haunted me for a long time. We saw I was reading 3rd Nephi. I was cross-referencing 3rd Nephi with the Joseph Smith translation and with the King James Version of the Bible, trying to show that Joseph Smith translated this from the most correct book. And so we should see that the Joseph Smith translation matches the Book of Mormon, but it didn't. It matched the King James Version of the Bible. And I couldn't figure out how the Book of Mormon didn't match the Joseph Smith translation and how it matched the King James Version, because, you know, the most correct version should have matched. And so I sent a note over to my mom, and I asked her, I was on my mission, I sent a note to my mom saying, how do I reconcile this? That was actually one of the first real challenges that I had. I kind of shelved it and ran away, but that stuck, and that actually is going to come up later in our story, because that's kind of one of the trigger points for us. But
so I think I was, you know, obviously raised in the church and everything. My dad went through a period of inactivity right about the time my parents divorced. And so I kind of had, my families were both Mormon, but it didn't, there was more like a fundamental side and a more liberal side. And so I think that always kind of, for me, created a little bit of turbulence in that way, because my dad and stepmom were both professionals who worked. My stepmom worked outside of the home always. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and that was a huge deal for her. So there was always kind of conflict between those two things. So growing up, I was always really aware of women's issues and that kind of stuff. And as a second grader, I went to my second grade library at school, and I happened to see a book about Brigham Young. And I was like, I recognized, like, that guy was a prophet. And I was really excited. I lived in West Texas, and I was like, you know, nobody even knew what Mormons were there. And so I was super excited about that. So I pulled this book down, and it said that Brigham Young had two wives. And I was like, what a horrible book this is, you know, the lies. I was so offended. And I went home from school that day, and I said, Mom, I saw this book at the library about Brigham Young, and it said he was married to two women. And she like looked down, like embarrassed. And she was like, oh, actually, that's true. And I remember just as a 7-year-old being so freaked out by that and thinking like, just not being able to really process that and feeling really like Mormons, from my point of view, were like these really super, like they did all the right things. And that seemed really weird to me. So that always, from that moment, was something that bothered me, tremendously bothered me. I always struggled with polygamy and trying to understand that. So I took a class at BYU, a church history class, and the professor was an ancient guy. I mean, he was just like the oldest guy I'd seen on campus. He was so old. I don't remember his name, but he loved polygamy and he talked about it all of the time. And he would get up in class and he would recommend books about polygamy for us to read. And one of the books he recommended had just came out that year, and it was In Sacred Loneliness.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, if I can read this story from the point of view of the women, then I feel like I can get past all of this, like, angst I have over this. If I can just see how it was good for them, then I can be okay with it. And so I remember I went to the BYU library to check that out, and I felt like almost naughty, like I was doing something wrong, you know? I'm like, and I remember saying to myself, it's at the BYU library. Like, why are you freaking out about checking out this book that your professor recommended to you? So I checked it out, and I started reading the story of those women. And I was devastated reading that book. And I just cried for like 3 days while I read it. And Toby was like, stop reading that if it's making you so sad. And I really went through a real crisis of faith at that time. And then I kind of came out of it. So that was like my first moment when I kind of quit believing for a while, but yeah, then I kind of worked myself. Yeah, I had
like that too, mm-hmm. where you would come up to the edge and then you just retreat.
Yeah.
And you just stop asking the question and go on into your home teaching.
Right. And Toby was in grad school at the time, and he was working 2 full-time jobs, and I was a stay-at-home mom, and we just had a lot going on, and we didn't really have, I don't know, it just wasn't the right time to really deal with that. He couldn't deal with it. He didn't want to talk about it. And so I just kind of retreated from that and started reading a lot of Farms and Fair and trying to figure it out that way.
Well, and I was at the same time going through, I was studying physics as an undergrad for a while. And so my knowledge of science was just going through the roof. You know, I had always had a propensity towards science and math, and I had just a fantastic chemistry teacher in high school, Hallie Heiner. He's one of the guys that probably shaped my life more than anybody else, because he developed this love for knowledge and learning and understanding how the world worked. And so he inspired me to go into science. And so I was learning about evolution. I was learning about biology and the age of the earth. And at the same time, I had grown up reading Cleon Skousen and Joseph Fielding Smith and, you know, reading the words of the prophets condemning evolution and really driving this hardline opinion. And so when Pam and I would have discussions about this, you know, she would just flat out say that she believed in evolution, and I would pull out Joseph Fielding Smith and say, you can't. You know, it's just simply
it's true.
Not possible.
We had these conversations in his parents' living room, and he's like, you just can't. You can't. Like, and I was like, I do. This is how I feel.
It doesn't matter that the evidence points that direction. The prophet right here says that you can't believe in this. So I was in this, I mean, my cognitive dissonance was just going through the roof, learning more and more about how cohesive all these theories are in the age of the earth. And at the same time, I'm getting hooked in with the Farms guys on the backside. A lot of the physics professors I was working with were trying to write papers to reconcile evolution with the Book of Mormon teachings and with the age of the earth and how, you know, how can you believe in a dualism and no death before Adam and have that work in an evolutionary model. So we're, you know, working my hardest with these very, very smart guys to reconcile, you know, what you see in the world with what's taught over the pulpit.
What was their conclusion?
Oh, it's magical beyond belief. I mean, the best theory was that animals before Adam didn't have real spirits. They were just animated by God. And then,
there's some apologists who believe this about human beings too, that there were human beings, but they just didn't have souls.
All the Neanderthals, it was all just part of the clay up until the point that Adam and Eve started and they were the first real live beings.
I like the copy. I think that's the more common theory, right? The mimeograph, like the world was just constructed like an exact copy of another one. Still just pushes the question back in time.
Right.
Well, that's where the dinosaurs came from. It was just ancient.
Of other planets.
And they just happened to fall in the right layers. But, God's a god of order.
And I was comfortable with evolution. I took Bio 100 my freshman year at college, and Dr. Bradshaw was my teacher, and he was, you know, all about teaching evolution. So he got up in that class and told us about it. And I didn't know anything about it before then, but I remember having like almost a real spiritual moment learning about it. It seemed really beautiful to me, and I thought it was great. And I remember there were people getting up in the middle. It was in the Joseph Smith Auditorium. And if you know that, it's this huge, huge room with like 1,000 seats in it. And people were screaming at him and telling him you know, that he was going against the church, and he was telling us, you know, I have permission to say these things. And
I remember, you know, in my classes, people getting up and walking out.
Right. Those people were walking out.
Big undergraduate classes. My experience is the same. I took many classes at BYU, both in anthropology, linguistics, and just the basics, where evolution was present, and it was always presented as a fact, unless you were in the religion department.
Right.
And then they said it was a lie. Kind of like Toby. Yeah. You missed your calling, Toby. You should be teaching Book of Mormon at BYU right now.
I should be a seminary teacher. I would have been a good one.
All right. So there's marital discord around evolution. And
yeah, but it was never ever like, it was something that we just, it was funny thinking back now, because I was arguing from the fundamentalist position saying that prophets are infallible.
And I was always the liberal California position that I was arguing from. Yeah. So it
all came to a head for me. I kind of still think back on how weird this was, but we ended up down in the Provo Library for some reason. I think it might have been because we could get VHS tapes for free or something. There was something weird that was going on that we were, but we ended up down in the Provo Library, and I just was walking through the science section, and I looked down and I saw a book called The Demon Haunted World.
Ooh.
And I couldn't, I mean, it just like leapt off the shelf at me. And so I started thumbing through the different sections, and there were a few different Carl Sagan books there, but I ended up grabbing The Demon Haunted World and checking it out. And I raised very Mormon in Idaho, and like anything with the name demon in it was taboo. So I mean, even checking that book out was just like a big risk. I got that and I took it home, and I probably read, and Pam can remember this story too. I probably read maybe four or five pages, and I threw it across the room. I literally just threw the book across the room, and I shut down, went catatonic for a couple of days almost, because it was, you know, those few pages reconciled all of the issues that I had been experiencing for 10 years. All of the challenges of trying to make things work in my head, trying to like make everything work, and it just all completely came into focus.
So being presented with the answer after putting all the effort into the false solutions,
and it
disorienting.
It was, and everything just became crystal clear. I just almost shut down. I just didn't know what to do.
And I remember asking him, what are you reading? You know, cause he seemed really upset, and he was like, don't read this book. You'll hate it. And I was like, is it pornographic? Like what? Like I had no idea what it was. I had no idea. I was like, Demon Haunted World. Is it some sci-fi weird? Like I didn't know what it was. I'd never heard of Carl Sagan. So.
Wow.
So really at that point in time, everything deconstructed for me. All of Mormonism, all of religion, all of superstition basically went away. I didn't know anything about church history. I mean, I still had a few little tidbits that I had issues with the, you know, the Joseph Smith translation problem and a few other little tidbits, but all belief basically just kind of went away. Over the next few days, I just, you know, it was a combination of fear of letting down my parents, and divorce is so stigmatized in the culture that I grew up in that, you know, I couldn't think of, you know, if I came out and I told Pam that I didn't believe anymore, that she would be forced to divorce me, because part member families don't work in a lot of cases. I couldn't see how that would work, and I didn't want to let my family down. I was scared about what life would be like outside of the church, and so even though for the most part I'd say probably 80%, I was just convinced that everything was just not real. I just buckled it up. I just stopped. I really stopped believing. And this is probably,
I bet that was a year after I read In Sacred Loneliness. So this was all happening in graduate school.
Maybe like 2001, probably.
Probably right around that time, I would say. Well, no, I read In Sacred Loneliness earlier. So maybe it was several years later. Maybe it was several years later. So
2001, I basically stopped believing. I don't believe in spiritualism. I don't believe in anything. But I'm super active Mormon, doing my callings, paying my tithing, did everything.
Right. We were all in as far as what we were doing, you know.
But you didn't discuss.
We did not have this conversation. No. I didn't tell him, well, I mentioned before, I kind of was talking, I would bring up a few things. You know, Joseph Smith married other people's wives, and he would just be like, I don't want to hear this, you know, just stop reading it. And so my sense of him was that he wasn't interested in exploring that. And his sense of me later, because it was probably 5 years later, I guess, for you, yeah. was that I wasn't interested because I had kind of come backed off of that ledge and been like, okay, all my family's in, all my friends are in. Nobody was leaving the church that I was aware of. And so you just didn't leave. So,
and
that, you know,
like, frankly,
and I believed in God still. So I was like, this is as good as anything. And this is right. what I know. So that was kind of how I was for a long time.
And I looked at it and I didn't mind church service. I actually liked serving and helping and, you know, there was, the church wasn't ever really bad. It was just kind of it was everything that we grew up with. It was our culture. It was, you know, wrapped up in identity. My whole family, that's, you know, it consumes most conversations that we have with our families. And I just couldn't imagine a world without it. And I think that just scared me into a shell.
Hmm.
So, but we did eventually move past that.
Congratulations.
And one Sunday, we were at church, and we had a Sunday school lesson.
About how many years later are we talking?
This is many years later. So, 2001, this was 2011, actually.
Yeah.
2011.
So, 10 years later,
a decade later. We'd been all in primary president. He was a young men's president, you know.
State priesthood callings.
And by this time, you're in St. Louis. Now.
We're in St. Louis, and we have a really great ward that we love, and everyone's really close because there's not that many Mormons out there. And anyway, we came home from church, and did you want to say something?
Oh, go ahead. And, actually, let me jump. No, sorry. You can cut this part out of you.
Toby was really agitated after church one day. And I was like, what's up with you? And he was
say
like,
more agitated than Toby's baseline. Agitation.
More than baseline.
True. More agitated than normal. So I was just kind of bugging him, like, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you being so grouchy? You know, what's up?
And this is like, let's say January, February.
Yeah.
So of 2011. We had just started, you know, how they recycle every 4 years in Sunday school. They recycle the lessons. So we just started New Testament.
And so, anyway, I finally got him to open up after a while about what was really bugging him. And it took a long time of me kind of coming back and saying, you're still grouchy. What's wrong with you? And I guess 3 hours later, he finally told me what was bugging me.
I just kind of said, I think it's all bullshit. and she's like, well, what do you mean? And I'm not sure I want to do this anymore. And she's I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Yeah. But I realized, you know, pretty quick he was talking about the church. And he was kind of like, you know, we're going to Chicago. And I just want to have an enjoyable time. Can we have a glass of wine when we're in Chicago? It was our anniversary was coming up. And I was like, no, what is wrong with you? Like, what is going on, you know?
And by the way, we never drank. We were like the picture perfect Mormon family.
Yes. 4 kids, 2 boys, 2 girls, yeah. You know, doing our best.
And so, it was a weird request because I really didn't ever.
It was out of the blue.
It's not anything I ever really had any inkling for. There's no like real draw to it, but I don't know. It just was eating at me.
And so I was like, what are you talking about? You know? And he's like, just answer. I have 3 questions. If you can answer me 3 questions, if you can answer these questions, then I'll never bug you about that again. And I was like, okay. And he's like, but if you can't answer them, I think we should just have a glass of wine on our anniversary. And I was like, what's he going to ask, you know? So I think I agreed to that, thinking, I read Fair a lot. We can figure this out, whatever it is. Someone has an answer to whatever he's talking about. So your questions were?
So the first one was the Joseph Smith translation of Book of Mormon one. Uh-huh. On why they didn't match. Because that was actually what the trigger issue was, because we had read Matthew 5 in Sunday school that day. And every 4 years when that lesson came back up, or every 2 years, I should say, when they talked about it in 3rd Nephi as well, it just, all of these doubts and all of this, you know, the fact that I know that it doesn't work just would rush back to my head. So that's what triggered it. So I put that one down. The second one was on the Dead Sea Scrolls. So there just, I mean, there have been just a dozens of Dead Sea Scroll finds over the 90s and the 2000s. And, you know, why weren't those validating, you know, the Isaiah translations from?
Because you remember the old days in the 80s when the firesides would come around. Oh. It was the church was about to be proven true right. in the eyes
Any
of the
minute.
World.
Yep.
When
Any
these
minute.
Scrolls have been found. Yep. They were mm-hmm. big in Salt Lake.
Yeah. Yep. I was really into that kind of stuff. I loved archaeology. So that stuff was a big deal for me too.
So the Dead Sea Scrolls, and what was the third one? Oh gosh.
Oh, the Abraham.
Book oh, the Book of Abraham. Yeah, the papyrus. And not the papyrus. We actually didn't know about the papyrus.
We didn't know
at the
anything
time.
About that.
But the facsimiles and why the facsimiles didn't match. And so I kind of wrote those three things to her and I
think you wrote them on a piece of paper.
I did. I
actually.
Wrote them on a paper and I kind of huddled in the corner in a ball, like not knowing what she's going to do.
So I was like, well.
But wait, you win either way. One way you get a glass of wine and a nice time in Chicago. The other way you get your testimony restored, right? Win-win.
That's
win-win.
Right.
Win-win.
That's
right. What he didn't know was that 2 months earlier, or a month earlier, I guess, I had had a conversation with one of my best friends that I grew up with, and I won't say where, but, that I grew up with, and we started talking about the church and the temple. And different things that bothered us about it and things that seemed off and didn't seem right. And I had admitted to her for the first time that I did not believe that the church was true. And if it wasn't for my family, I would probably be out. And Toby didn't know about that conversation nope. until later. But I had had that conversation with her and she had similar feelings.
Wow.
She's still in. I don't even think she knows I've left, actually.
No.
So I looked up FAIR, of course, my go-to for like, please someone answer this question. And I read their explanations because those were actually not the things I normally looked up. I was more concerned about polygamy, blacks in the priesthood, some of these like feminist issues that bothered me.
And I didn't have an issue with those because if the church was true, they could put whatever rules down they wanted to.
Uh-huh.
My issues were the logical inconsistencies across the different components.
And so I read through it and I said to him, this is all circular reasoning. This does not answer anything at all. And so he started just doing Google searches, I think, at that point for yeah. it. And he found Mormon Think. And he's like, you have to come read this. And so I went in and he was like shaking, you know, and I sat down and I read the thing about the Book of Abraham, I think. Yeah. And 5 minutes into that, I said, I'm done. It's not true.
So we just spent the next probably a few days. Like really not, I mean, we decided to go very slow. We're not going to do anything rash.
Well, at first we were like, well, of course we won't leave the church. We'll still send the kids on missions.
That's what everybody says, but then heroin comes calling.
I know.
Sooner or later.
There are hookers out there. We can't stay in the church. So, we were going to stay. And then I started reading people's stories online about people who had left
yeah.
because I was still very terrified of that. Like, we have to raise our kids this way. There's no really other way to raise your kids except for this. And I didn't know what that would look like. So I started reading people's personal stories and I became convinced pretty quickly that staying was a bad idea.
Yeah.
But we went back and forth between he would want to stay and I would want to go. He would want to go and I would want to stay. We did that for a while.
So the real trigger, honestly, that what kind of pushed me to actually like bring the issue up was our oldest son was 11 at the time. And I had worked in young men's. I'd worked in young men's for 10 years. And I just looked at him and how impressionable he was and how firm a believer he was. I looked and I saw the arc that was going to play out for him. You know, his whole life was basically laid out in front of him. You know, get the priesthood when you're 12, go on a mission, get married. You know, he'll repeat the same cycle that I had. The 2000s were pretty rough, you know, as far as belief goes. It became difficult. You know, I had challenges with George Bush, you know, on the yeah. war and the role that religion started to play in politics. I just became more and more uneasy with that. And then Hinckley's statements that he was putting out and, you know, the church running away from polygamy and, you know, it just became difficult to, they weren't being honest.
Right.
And so I looked at that and I saw the church changing and I saw them ingraining in doctrines and behaviors that I didn't necessarily think that were good for the kids. And so that really kind of forced us. Our daughters were really young at the time. we'd both, you know, Pam's got a mom who's a dentist, who was always a really good example of women playing an active role in society. And we looked up to that. And so that pushed us. I mean, that was what really pushed me to action on that. But at the same time, we didn't know how we'd raise kids outside the church.
Right. I had no idea. So I think pretty quickly I started ordering like secular parenting books, trying to figure it out. Cause I was one of those moms that like read everything I could about how to be a good parent and what you're supposed to do right and what's wrong. And so that was a big deal for me. Like I needed, like I didn't know what to do anymore. I didn't know what to tell them, really. I felt kind of lost in that role all of a sudden. Like I used to say, this is what we do and why. Even if I disagreed with some things, overall, I kind of felt like it was a pretty decent way to go. So I did feel really lost about that.
One of the things that I think helped us, though, was, and we didn't really realize this until we looked back, we never raised our kids to base decisions on, like, fear of punishment or fear of, you know, or blessings in heaven.
Right. We never really talked about that kind of stuff. I think the metaphysical kind of stuff, we had both backed away from a long time before we left the church. So we weren't really raising our kids with all of that kind of very spiritually based kind of stuff. It was more like a decisions, like good and bad kind of thing,
so which that, I think that was actually helpful. Helped quite a bit. We were reading through kind of secular parenting books. At the same time, we were reading Bushman and Quinn and Von Brody and basically everything we could get our hands on. We found Nom and we started looking at book lists on Nom and post-Mormon and, you know, a bunch of different groups, found Mormon stories and started listening to Dylan, found your podcast, started listening to your podcast.
And then it was all over.
You know,
it was all over from there. We were trying to decide whether or not we were going to stay in the church or leave. And there was a Mormon Stories podcast that talked about raising kids in the church. And then there was a Mormon Expression podcast that addressed similar things. And I listened to the two and I was like, we have to go. Like that model of staying is crazy making. Like that, everybody seems so frustrated. It was so complicated for the kids. The kids couldn't figure out, you know, are those people Mormons like us, or they did? It seemed really, really complicated to try to deconstruct what they learned at church every week.
And the kids, the kids were awesome through this. So we're still going to church. We had the benefit of having time. We don't have any family out in Missouri. We're isolated. You know, we've got good friends that were in the church, but we also made a lot of good friends that were outside of the church. And so we had the opportunity to talk to some really great friends of ours that we're still good friends with that were raised Catholic. And, you know, their exit story from Catholicism and the impact that that had on them and how they raised their kids. We leveraged them pretty heavily. And so we kind of worked through all of this stuff. And it was fun to sit down with the kids after church and ask them what they learned. And, you know, our six-year-old at the time had learned about.
Asked him, we said, is there anything at church that seems like the story doesn't make sense to you? And so he's like, and he was seven because he was about to be baptized. He was seven and he's like, what is up with the Noah's Ark story? And he's like, that just does not make sense, you know? And we were like, oh, you know, here we are insisting they listen to these stories. And he's going, this is bizarre. So that was interesting, I
and
think,
then the,
for us.
The dude touching the rocks was the other one.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Popped up and, like, why would
the dude why that the lit up the rocks? Like, what? And so then all the kids started coming up with things that seemed really weird to them that we talked about at church. And we were like, yeah, we can't keep doing this. We just can't. There's no way. So, but then what to do?
Yeah, what to do was the big, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, we kind of had, we had the pattern of staying. We had right. the pattern of leaving, but not knowing where to go. How do you teach kids morality? And because we, you know, I don't know at what point you lost faith in God, really.
I would say it happened a week after I lost faith in the church, like completely. Like I really gave it up, because I said before that I had had doubts and I had already come to the conclusion that it wasn't really true. But it was about a week after the Mormon thing that I was like, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, and we also jumped into the biblical textual analysis as well.
Right. At first, I assumed we'd just become Christians. All of our friends were Lutheran. All of them, everyone in our neighborhood. There was a big mega church there that everybody went to. And I was thinking, all along, we've kind of been these oddball Mormons. And I was involved in the Lutheran church for their preschool programs and other things already. So we tried that once, and that was not at all. I was like, this is the same thing in a different package. It was the same thing. It just was very clearly the same thing.
We made some mistakes telling the kids. Some of the kids handled it better than others. You know, our oldest was, he was really the one that really had the belief, and we probably could have handled that better with him. He struggled with it because it was, he had a firm belief. He was the kid that would get up and bear his testimony every month. And he
not
prayed
like
and he believed. And one of the things we've been very careful with is never to force our beliefs on the kids. We let them believe what they want. We help them and we teach them. And we obviously have a very high science bent on what we do. And they watch a lot of podcasts and documentaries but you know, our girls both still believe in God, and we don't have an issue with that at all. If they want to learn about religion, we learn about religion. We teach them about the origins, and we teach them about the traditions, and that was a big deal for us.
How long? I know, and this might be jumping ahead, but you guys got involved in the secular society there in St. Louis.
Yeah, that happened almost immediately, I think. It was really weird for us to suddenly not have anything to do on Sunday. I felt really antsy about that.
Right.
Like, I have to go somewhere.
Like, you felt like you were cheating at life. Like,
right.
Life shouldn't be easy like
right,
this.
Right, right. Like,
I'm supposed to be doing a whole bunch of shit that I don't care about all
Sunday
the time.
Morning should be really stressful. Not all of this empty, like, hours in the day. But we didn't want to, I think we quit going in June to the Mormon church. And I think we went to the Ethical Society the next week.
Yeah.
But they had summer hours and they weren't really operating. So we showed up and we were like, summer hours? What is this?
Did
so
these guys take summer off?
They
I didn't
take
know that
the
was
summer.
Legal.
So like, how can you not be here? So the people there gave us a tour and kind of talked to us about it and said, come back in September. So we were forced at that point to learn how to take bike rides. And we went to Six Flags a lot that summer on Sunday mornings because in St. Louis, everybody is in church on Sunday morning. Everybody. It is a really, really religious place. And there aren't people home. Everyone's at church. Every church parking lot is packed. And so Six Flags was the place to be.
Jealous. It was, Utah used to be that way, but now all these damn ex-Mormons.
just ruining the place. So we would go to Six Flags Sunday morning and have the whole park to ourselves, which was great. So we did a lot of that bike riding. We kind of learned how to relax with our kids that summer.
Now we did keep a family home evening thing though.
We renamed it Science Monday.
So every Monday we would watch a science documentary with the kids.
Or we would do like make volcanoes or slime or do a science experiment. Experiment. Wow. So I always kind of liked family home evening. It was fun. We always did fun stuff. We didn't do churchy stuff necessarily ever.
Funny, as I sit and watch you guys, obviously listeners can't see you. When you were talking about the time leading up to your disaffection, your faces became more like stressed, and you could just see that. And just the change in your countenance right now talking about this element, because you were just mentioning a minute ago, that transition when you're there on the parapet, they're on the edge. Mm-hmm. It seemed so stressful.
It was horrifying, actually.
It is. And I really liked how you guys explained it with the, you know, losing faith. And so many people, especially believers, associate those two so readily. Losing faith and then moving on. They aren't the same thing.
No.
And for me, it was a few years gap. For a lot of people, that's the case. But once you accept it and move beyond, it is a sudden de-stressor. Like all of this anxiety and problem kind of goes away.
Yeah. And we stayed in the church fully active every week for 6 months before we left after we were done.
Uh-huh.
And it took us that long to kind of like get up the nerve and to be able to.
And it's so scary. The world's a scary place.
Well, so the scary thing about how are we going to raise the kids? Are we going to be able to raise them in a reasonable way? You know, what are we going to do with our families? Cause there's, you know, we're not around our families. We're miles and miles and miles away from them. And how do you call your parents up and break this news to them? And do we need to do that? And, you know, what's the, you know, what ended up with my family was my son was supposed to get ordained in November.
And Toby's parents were on a mission at this time, so...
No.
It was a... No?
No. I think they
you
were...
You can erase that.
I don't know. I'd have to work through the timing on that. I know I called them. I don't think they were on their mission then.
Anyway.
Yeah, so anyway. I lost my train of thought.
So summer, you Six Flags summer. Yeah.
Six Flags summer. And we started up at the Ethical Society in the fall. And I think we went...
So give us a brief. What is the Ethical Society?
Oh, okay. So the Ethical Society was formed back in the 1800s. So not that long after Mormonism. And it was just like a group of atheists who decided they wanted a place to make a difference in the world. And they formed themselves very much like a church in a lot of ways. There's hymns that they sing, and which was weird because you're singing, but just about
people.
But
they're completely atheistic as opposed to Unitarians.
Totally.
Yeah, there's no belief at all.
No metaphysical beliefs at all. Yeah. It is an atheist organization.
I don't know that we even heard the word atheist there. It's a secular humanist organization.
That's
very egalitarian, very kind of focused on how to make things better in the world.
I think the first time we went, the speaker was the guy who wrote The God and Sex One. Roy Dale? What's his name? Dale? Roy Dale something?
Fantastic podcasting. Continue, please.
He got up, and the entire thing was about sex. And so they were celebrating sex. This is the first meeting we went to.
This was just adults, though, because
it was an adults only
meeting. They split the kids off to Sunday
school. Isn't it wonderful? The first time you go to a non-Mormon service, and there's no kids there.
No kids. Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Because the kids would be there for like 5 minutes at the beginning and do a little thing, and then they would leave. And so the whole thing was about sex. And we were like, you know, we'd never been to church. So that was about sex before. And he said, raise your hand if you masturbate. And the entire congregation raised their hands. And he said, can you imagine asking that in a Mormon church? And so that was our first experience with the Ethical Society. And we were fairly active in that for quite a while.
Yeah. Yeah, so we would go, and I mean, it was just amazing. You would go there, and they would bring these people from all around the world that had just done amazing things. You know, this guy that had organized clinics in Africa to fix fistulas, and he got up there for an hour, and he just talked about, like, the suffering that these women went through, and what he had done, and how he had organized it, and all the goodness that was there. And they would send a collection plate around, and whoever the person was that was there for the meeting would get half of the collection plate for that day. And so they ran a very tight ship as far as budget goes, and it was all open, and you had open access to everything, and then they would give money to the speakers. And there was a lady that had set up a STEM school in downtown St. Louis, in the ghetto in St. Louis, and was like raising all of these poor black kids out of poverty and like giving them engineering skills. And teaching them, she had a bank that was running at the school, and they had a jet engine that Boeing had donated, and they were teaching kids, like, you know, how to work on engines. And I mean, these stories, you would walk away from these stories so inspired and so, like, uplifted that humanity can do amazing things. It was just the most inspirational thing you could imagine.
It was fantastic. And I learned that I cry more in humanist church than I do more at Mormon church. And I was the only one crying, I think, because my upbringing was to cry at emotional things. So I was always crying there because of the emotional, inspiring stories.
Yeah, I think for you guys, and then for me, I transitioned. I was on and off again for a Unitarian for about 6 years. And people forget that sometimes. And that was a really great transition for me as going from this, you know, it's like we were heroin addicts with religion. And some people can just go cold turkey, but not me. I needed the...
I did too. I felt very, like I said, antsy.
Methadone.
I felt antsy. We have to go to some sort of meeting.
And is that past for you now?
Yeah.
Or do you still feel?
I would like to think that if there was an ethical society in San Diego that we would go.
Occasionally,
I liked
for sure.
The community. I liked there was structured education for the kids. They did comparative religion studies. They gave them a time and an ability to talk with other kids about hard issues, about, you know, peer pressure and drugs and sex and death.
We did service projects that the kids organized and got to plan.
I sort of miss it a little bit. I would probably go to some sort of society like that. And of course, we started one in Salt Lake, and it was successful until we got bored with it. I went to the Unitarian Church for a while, and I would probably still keep going, but I like to do other things.
Right.
And my kids, they don't have an interest in going at all, and I'm not going to force them to go to this meeting.
Yeah, I feel like we would probably do that, but I assume there's stuff like that, and we don't. We spend our Sundays at the beach.
We bike, we hike, we go to the zoo, we always make it family time.
Right. I found that a lot of folks like you, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on, who made the successful transition, tend to be very active people. They have a lot of things going on that fill that gap. And if you just went home and sat there and watched Netflix,
right,
you probably miss church quite a bit.
But, I think so.
But if you start, you know, there's these experiences that can be learning, edifying, spiritual, all that. And it can be at the beach. It can be on the bicycle.
Yeah. Right. And I remember when we left, I said, I don't want to spend the day watching TV on Sunday. I'm like, it's always been a sacred time for me. We need to make it sacred in a different kind of way. And I'm not as intense about that as I was. Like, this is sacred time. We have to go do something really amazing. We do lots of fun stuff on Sundays. It's a fun day for us.
So is there anything about the church you miss anymore?
I loved a lot of the music, the multi-part harmonies, and there's a lot of that that I really love.
You're a man after my own heart, because I'm not a great singer. Yeah. I can do okay. But singing in that congregation was the only chance I got to do something like that. And there's not been anything that is reproduced. There's some local community choirs, but I don't feel strong enough to sing in them. And I miss that.
Yeah, I miss singing too. I still sing all the time, but not church hymns. And I love Christmas music. I still listen to a lot of Christmas music around the holidays.
We still celebrate all the holidays. We kind of strip out most of the supernatural portions of it, but it's cultural for us.
I've started dropping holidays. This is recent. Oh, I pretty much dropped Easter.
Easter, I feel like we didn't make too big of a deal of Easter this year. The kids like the egg hunts.
Well, here's what happened to me this year. I got home. It was a couple days before Easter, and my kids were excited. I'd been recording a podcast, got home, and they had gone over to the grocery store on their bikes and bought me a bunch of eggs, and they left a trail to a basket. I'm like, oh shit! So I went and bought them baskets and stuff, because they did it for me first.
That's cute.
They drew first blood, so I had to play along.
No, I do. I mean, with Ramadan going on now, I think it would be fun to teach the kids about holidays and in other cultures and other religions, but it's too fun just to go to the beach.
We went to the beach on Easter Sunday, and that was the best because we were the only people there. Even in San Diego, which is a like pretty secular place in some ways, nobody went to the beach on Easter except for us.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So I think you guys have made a really good, successful transition. Any other secrets of a happy life now other than the beach? And not paying 10% of your income.
I would say one of the biggest things when we look back, and this is advice that we got from you guys on the podcast, was just going slow and understanding that you're going to be processing a lot of stuff, and you get really excited about information that you learn. And like your first instinct is to just go blare it out and blast it out. You know, we've read Peter Boghossian's book, basically Deconstructing Faith and focusing on epistemology, and understanding that the best way to help people understand the situation that we're in is not to fact bomb them, but to help them understand how we get to truth and how it's different than how they consider it. We completely respect our family's ability to believe and willing, you know, their desire to believe, and we don't want to pull them out of the church in any way. That's been challenging for us. Because it's been difficult for them to understand how to work with us, and it's been difficult for us to be able to really, you know, live our lives in an authentic way that's not seen as threatening or offensive to them.
Right. I think that's probably been the hardest thing, dealing with family, and I do feel like there is a lot of misunderstandings that happen, even though we try really hard.
On both sides.
On both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think we're all a little like extra sensitive at times, because you do feel that threat, I think, from both ways. Like trying to create a space for ourselves to be authentic and not step on toes while we do that is a really, really hard line to walk. And we don't always do that well, but we're trying and they're trying. So we're getting there slowly. But I think that's probably the hardest thing. And with some family members, you know, there's a, I had a sibling say to me, you know, you have no beliefs at all. Like, how do you walk around making decisions? How do you, you know, you're just like, you're just, like, you don't believe in anything. And I said, well, that's not fair. Yeah. I believe in being honest and kind and, but that he's like, but you can't, cause that you just, that's not coming from anywhere. Like he doesn't, it was difficult for, that was really difficult, I think.
But they're being forced to address stuff that we had a decade to address internally.
Right.
You know, we look at this and you know, it's just.
Or longer, the seeds of doubt you talk about go back to your mission, back when you were young.
And so, I mean, our transition out was relatively easy because neither of us were really fully vested in the church. We had to work through the consequences of what to do with the kids, but leaving the church was not difficult for us from a belief perspective. The belief was gone. The thing that I would say though is Facebook is not a place to try to deconvert people.
No.
It's not a place to try to have deep conversations or to try to convince people of anything. And I think that's probably the thing that we've seen the most. I mean, we meet up with friends that we haven't seen in years and they meet us in person and we might not be wearing clothes that would cover garments and we might be, you know, our lifestyle isn't a Mormon lifestyle anymore. And they're surprised by that because the way that we live on Facebook doesn't, you know, we don't blast out quotes about polygamy and blood atonement.
Right, right.
But that would, the other piece of advice that I'd give is.
Well, this is an interesting segue because, you know, we mentioned at the top of the podcast that, you've been good friends for a long time. People I've trusted to be moderators in this ex-Mormon world. And I really enjoy the opinion you have because you guys have been sort of outside. And this is one of the reasons I selected you. Because you were in St. Louis, you were outside the Mormon and ex-Mormon circles. So you were a little bit detached.
Yeah.
So tell me what observations or what recommendations you have after after observing the ex-Mormon world and me forcing you to be moderators.
I think that was really healthy for us because there were people that we were surrounded by who had never been Mormon and were in our same stage of life and were just living normal adult lives. And they weren't losing their minds in the way that a lot of people go through, I think.
Like when the ex-Mormon adolescents you're talking
about.
Yeah. Nobody was doing that. It would have been very awkward for us to do that around a bunch of grown-ups. Like, cause they were all doing really well and nobody, I don't think anybody would have had any patience for us, like going through that Mormon adolescence phase.
Yeah. So we learned to drink with people who had been drinking their entire lives.
It was, of course, we moved out to North Carolina in 2008 and back to Utah in 2010. And I started the podcast in the middle of that, but you're right. That was extremely important for me to see how the rest of the world models behaviors because as we've talked in the podcast, there's a flip flop. You go from this one extreme in the church to these ex-Mormon frat parties.
Right.
And it's hard to figure out where the middle is.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily even think that's a bad thing. I just think it can be very destructive for people depending on.
Distracting is a word.
Distracting.
I agree with you. It's not a bad word, but it sometimes might take longer for the gears to engage.
Yeah.
Where if somebody had those behaviors and those things modeled, like the thing Toby said, just the advice, go slow.
Right.
You get into these internet forums and everything seems like it's on turbo. Like everybody's on speed.
Yeah.
And she's like, slow down.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that was really important for us to, we would kind of come in and out of, you know, Utah and other places like that and see that sort of Mormon adolescence. But there was no real way for us to go through that.
Oh, that crazy cruise, though. That was kind of I'd say us kind of looking in on.
Well, let's be clear. People who aren't in the church still get drunk from time to time.
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. I'm not talking about, I don't know.
Oh, we went to some raucous parties in St. Louis that were a lot of fun. And,
right, right.
And we ended up staying the night at friends' houses and stuff.
Yeah.
It was fine. But
having had too much to drink.
I think often that's for ex-Mormons, it's a matter of scale as opposed to this being something that happens occasionally versus this something that happens every Friday night.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so for us. Like I would say, you know, we'd go to maybe a New Year's Eve party and people would get drunk at the New Year's Eve party in St. Louis.
Like a neighborhood block party where there's just a big cooler full of beer and you grab a beer if you're thirsty and it just becomes part of the that's just part of the fabric. It's not like you're not going to a party to get drunk. you're going to a party to have fun, and that's part of it. So it was fun.
What more would you say to the ex-Mormons, the people who are transitioning?
Well, I don't know.
I'd say that the thing that I guess concerns me the most is when people go from a fundamentalist belief and faith in a prophet and they try to replace that with somebody. When they try to replace it with a leader, with a benevolent leader, and they look for direction from a source, instead of trying to piece together, we have a very deconstructionist viewpoint. I mean, we'll look at different parts of society and different things from different people, and we'll piece together what we think works best. You know, there isn't anybody that we're loyal to. That's one of the things I've seen that kind of concerns me a little bit about some of the transitioning communities.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, not to name any names or anything.
It happens, but it's a product of the environment. It's not somebody coming in. I think you're absolutely right. It's not somebody coming in saying, I'm going to take advantage of this group. It does from time to time. There are people who are predatory, but they're oftentimes they invest this status because they're used to being followers.
Yeah.
Right.
And what's ironic is oftentimes they're used to being followers and they hate that about themselves. So they get this love, hate, push, pull thing that we've seen in some of the other communities, where the social in-group, out-group definition just starts getting really important to define, I'm part of this or I'm not. And right. That's all baggage from Mormonism.
Yeah, I think so. It's baggage from walking away from your culture and from your families in some ways.
Searching
for an identity. And I think that's something everybody probably goes through.
So do you guys feel like you've arrived? What related to this faith struggle still remains?
Well, family only.
Family is by far the biggest.
That's
all. We would like to get to a spot. We don't want to deconvert our anybody in our family. I mean, if they want to follow a similar path to us, that would be fine, and we'll help them along that journey. But getting to a point where there's understanding, you know, that our motivations were not the trite, you know, desire to sin or laziness or any of that. You know, we left. It's been a challenge for us to help them understand that we left because we studied and we came to the conclusion we don't believe it anymore. And we explain our, you know, the spiritual experiences we've had in the past, we understand them now in a different way. It's difficult to try to drive that understanding without it being threatening.
Right.
Because it is threatening. It threatens them to the core of what they are and what they believe in. And at the same time, without that understanding, we can't have a legitimate relationship that lets us speak about things beyond just a surface level.
And our family members who have been able to say, like, why? And, you know, kind of like face it a little bit themselves, but then, you know, say, okay, that's enough. I don't really want to hear anything else. Our relationship with them is very strong. Like, they understand where we're coming from. We understand where they're coming from. We're able to get along really well, and we don't have that conflict. But for some family members who've refused to let us, they don't want to hear why. So they have to come up with other reasons. And with those people, our relationships are more difficult. They take a lot more work to work around all of this unspoken stuff.
Yeah, I think that's very profound. I wish more people would ask why and start those conversations from their side. Because even after all these years, I have not figured out a way to initiate the conversation.
Yeah. Right.
Because it's framed in that mindset as a very aggressive, threatening action to go to somebody and saying, I want you to know why I don't believe.
Right.
I've yet to have anybody give me a good model on how to have that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't say that I came up with it. I would say my family members who have come to me, they came up with it.
Right.
They did it. It wasn't me. It
Absolutely.
Was their personality.
I wish more would do it, but I don't know how to get them to do it.
I don't think it can be initiated on this side. It's too threatening. It's too challenging.
And I'm sure there's plenty of people on our side who, when a hand reaches out, they'll snap that hand.
Yeah.
I'm not naive on that front. And it's a plain old difficult conversation to have. And I think you guys have it exactly right. For most of us, that's the one remaining issue. We live happy, fulfilled lives. I'm not going to claim that, like, ex-Mormons have some corner on happiness, right?
No, happens, no. We were happy Mormons.
I think I'm happier than I was in the church. Mm-hmm. I was reasonably happy in the church, but I like my life better now.
Yeah, I like my life better. I was pretty happy. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of a happy person naturally. It's sort of my state that I operate in. So I wasn't unhappy, but I had a lot of stress there that I don't have. And I would say the stress part of it has gone away. There's a lot of things I don't stress out about.
You know, back to that trip to Chicago. So after this
whole
blow-up.
Did you drink the wine? We have to know.
We drank the wine, and it was the worst moment of my life.
It was terrible.
I think I had 5 glasses of water to 1 glass of wine because I had to chase every sip.
What did you drink?
With a half.
Was it a nice Merlot?
It was a Pinot Grigio. No, I had a Pinot Noir.
No,
and
you took
had
mine.
Well, I started with the red, and then
You're right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So she ordered it. We got her
a
Pinot Noir.
What the hell is this stuff? You're supposed to put this in your body?
It was horrifying. Right. It was horrifying. And, of course, having had 5 glasses of water with it, there was no feeling from the wine. So I was like, that was, like, didn't even do anything.
And
you know,
tasted
so
gross.
What a rip.
It was our anniversary. It was really disappointing.
So, the thing, though, I mean, back to the pain piece, we went to the Natural History Museum in Chicago. And I remember walking into the Egyptian, they have a beautiful Egyptian exhibit in the basement of the museum. And we walked in there and we just walked around, and it was the first time in my life that I wasn't trying to piece the parts together.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to look at Native American history and make it fit or try to reconcile it. I felt like just this release of all this tension and all this stress. Wow. And it was just this euphoric experience.
Yeah, for me too, because I had always really been into Mayan history, like trying to connect that with Mormonism somehow. Uh-huh. That was really a passion of mine. I kind of wanted to be an archaeologist when I was a kid and find Mormon stuff, you know. And that was great to go walk around the museum. That was the best, not trying to make something fit into something that didn't make sense.
Well, great. Pam and Toby, I think, once again, I really look up to you both. You're obviously brilliant folks.
Thank you.
I hope you'll stick around. You're to be found around the community. So you still play nice. You're in the Mormon Expression podcast community.
Yes, we were there.
So thanks.
And John, we've thanked you before, but want to thank you here. I mean, the podcast and the work that you've done, bringing the people together, we really look at this podcast helped us transition where there was nothing else that was there. Mm-hmm. It filled a void in connecting us through and helping us process through and not making mistakes at you know, the first work party that I went to when I drank a little bit. And, you know, all of that stuff that's just damaging. I mean, you guys did a brilliant job of putting together that plan. Well, at the time, though, we've got to thank you immensely for that.
Well, I appreciate it. Meeting folks like you has made it all worth it. So, again, thanks, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Thank you. Heartbreaking by my time. Keep trying to hold back the fight. Keep crying. Heartbreaking by my time.